You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including a new lawsuit in Grants Pass, updates to forest management, and the history of logging those forests. I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
And I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
So Justin, you reported on the history of forestry labor in Oregon. What made you want to do this story?
Yeah, so I reported on a lawsuit, actually, by a forestry worker against a few Rogue Valley companies recently. And that worker was severely injured while clearing understory for wildfire prevention. And in the lawsuit, it mentioned that he was from Mexico and had an H-2B visa. Those are the guest worker visas for foreigners. And I learned that much of what's called labor-intensive forestry in the country is done by guest workers now. So that's the non-logging forestry work, like planting trees or doing fuels reduction, which is surprising, at least to me. And then I learned about when that started happening and, importantly, who was doing this work before it became dominated by contractors who rely on guest workers. And so 50 years ago, it looked a lot different. And that's when I learned about the HODATs. I'm relatively new to Oregon. I've only been here for about a year, so I hadn't heard of them. But the HODATs were a large worker cooperative that began in the 1970s. They were named after the kind of shovel they use, the HODAD. And it was created after laws were passed to require replanting those areas clear-cut from logging. So the federal government started handing out these contracts to do this replanting, which really can't be mechanized. It can't be automated. The landscape is pretty remote, sometimes hard to reach, and it takes workers, you know, to hike into the backcountry and just plant these trees by hand. And at the time, this was the 70s, there were all these counterculture hippies that were fleeing urban centers, wanting to, back to the lander types. And it was a perfect job for them. Here's Jerry Rust, a co-founder of the HODADs.
What we had were a bunch of refugees from the East Coast in California swarming into Eugene and never worked a lick in their life. That was one of the joys I had, teaching untrained workers and watching them bend their backs and sweat and come out of there dirty and just as high as kite.
And so the HODADs eventually were doing most tree planting in the country, actually, with a base here in Oregon, especially around Eugene. And they were organized into crews with names like Cheap Thrills, Red Star, and Full Moon Rising. What was interesting is that I heard about how each one of these crews kind of had their own culture and customs and even ideology. There was a Marxist crew. There was an all-lesbian crew. There were some crews known as partiers, really. But they all shared this worker cooperative model, which was democratic. They decided on how the contract money from the federal government was split. It could be doled out just evenly per person working, or workers could get paid per tree they planted, or it could, usually be some mixture of that. And no one was getting rich, but because it wasn't profit-driven by some form of management, crew members were making a decent amount of time depending on the project, especially, in the 70s and 80s. And at the very least, it seemed fair. Money was going to labor, so very much in line with the culture of the times.
Yeah, interesting. There's interesting history about planting trees in Oregon. And so the HODADs and this, worker cooperative model ended by the 90s, you say in your story. What caused their decline?
A few reasons. So it wasn't just one reason I learned. First, the HODADs were competing more with traditionally structured businesses, known as contractors. And those contractors were, like I mentioned previously, using workers from Latin America. Although at that time, most of those workers were undocumented. They were in Oregon at first to pick crops, especially pears around the Rogue Valley. And then they started moving into forestry. Contractors could pay them less, and so they could outbid the HODADs for federal contracts to do this tree planting. These contractors also lobbied against favorable employment laws for cooperatives. Namely, at this time, cooperatives didn't have to pay workers compensation. So there's an argument that there was kind of self-exploitation, which is ironic, going on in these worker cooperatives. But finally, the HODADs sort of started drifting away, too. The countercultural spirit itself started sort of fading out in the 80s. That energy had diminished, and HODAD members started going back to school. They started families, and leaving this type of work. So by the mid-90s, the HODADs were no more, unfortunately.
Interesting. So who's doing this kind of forestry work now then?
Not worker cooperatives run by hippies. So contractors hiring guest workers from Latin America are who get these federal contracts now, mostly. And that's going to be a topic of my next feature, looking in more into this industry, because, you know, Jackson County, where we are, is a national center for these businesses. I've learned there's dozens of contractors just in the Rogue Valley. And they request more H-2B visas for this kind of forestry work by far than any other county in the country. The kind of work has also shifted. People are still planting trees, but much of this work now is about wildfire mitigation, which also can't really be mechanized. It can't be automated. It just takes a lot of workers doing hard manual labor for many hours. Although Jerry Russ, the HODADs founder that we heard from earlier, says he thinks there's still space for a worker cooperative like the one they started in the 70s, although it would be harder now with just more employment regulations. But he at least hopes that some young people will get together and try to figure it out.
Yeah, interesting. Interested to see your second part of this story.
Yeah. So, Roman, let's turn to you. You went to a public meeting in Medford this week about proposed changes to the Northwest Forest Plan. What is the Northwest Forest Plan?
Yeah, it's this really big old plan for the U.S. Forest Service, and its lands in Oregon, Washington, and a small part of Northern California. And it basically guides the management of those forests, probably some of the same forests the HODADs were working in. And it was created in 1994, sort of in response to the timber wars of the 80s and 90s. And that was when, you know, environmental activists were protesting the logging of old growth forests. Those protests sometimes got violent. Judy Berry, who was a prominent activist at the time, was the victim of a car bombing that remains unsolved.
Wow.
And the goal of the plan was to protect endangered species in the region, especially the threatened northern spotted owl, which lives primarily in those old growth forests.
And why is the U.S. Forest Service making changes to that plan now?
Yeah, so it's obviously been 30 years since the plan came out. You know, some changes are ones that should have been there in the first place, primarily involving tribes in the plan. The Forest Service wants to include them a lot more in forest management. Climate change has also become a bigger issue, or just more prominent, and the threat of wildfires has grown as a result of that. So, you know, they want to focus a lot more on wildfire prevention and the active management of these forests. You know, an activist I talked to agreed that the plan needs to be updated. Here's Carol Valentine. She's the forest team coordinator for the Oregon Sierra Club.
Tribes were excluded from the original plan, and the fact that that could get remedied in a good way is excellent. You know, and we are in an era of climate change, and we need to think about the Northwest Forest Plan in that context.
So these activists you talked to were rallying outside the meeting about their concerns with the current proposals. What were some of those concerns?
Yeah, I think the big takeaway from that is that they're pushing for greater protections for these old growth forests. They essentially want to ensure that the protections remain strong in the plan because they have, you know, been supportive of the Northwest Forest Plan in its current iteration because of its strong protections. I talked to one activist who said that, you know, the Northwest Forest Plan is basically what has kept old growth forests alive in the Pacific Northwest. Without it, we wouldn't have a lot of, you know, old growth forests, and it's forced agencies to adapt and change their management style because of this plan. And so, you know, all of this is about protecting that northern spotted owl habitat and some other endangered species. Their habitat specifically has been declining in recent years, especially with increasing wildfires and habitat destruction through logging. So, you know, these activists want to grow that old growth habitat and help the owl population. They talked about this one change, which is sort of technical, but not really. It's basically changing the age limit for logging of trees from 80 years to 120 or 150 years. So right now in the plan, if you have trees that are older than 80 years, they're essentially prohibited from being logged in every part of the plan. You know, any trees older than 80 years. And they're changing that to 120 or 150 instead. And I'm trying to kind of understand that change because, you know, 80 to 120 year old trees are essentially these like burgeoning or up and coming old growth trees. And so protecting them would allow for more growth of old growth forests. I talked to Molly Jularaw, who's the forest supervisor for the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. And she essentially told me that the numbers are kind of arbitrary. You know, that 80 number was arbitrary when it was made. And, you know, so even though they'll, you know, she said that even though that they'll be allowing logging in those 80 to 120-year-old forests, it doesn't mean that they're all going to be clear-cut. There'll be treatments depending on the forest to protect from wildfire and things like that. While I was there at this public meeting they held, I also talked to a Forest Service biologist, Clint Emerson, who said that the 120 number that they now have is also arbitrary and not really based on any science. He essentially said it's sort of a negotiation between protecting the environment, logging, and protecting communities from wildfires. You know, there's a lot of lobbying from the timber industry. I was looking up just how much money they spend on lobbying. I think they spend around $10 million a year on lobbying efforts and another $7 to $10 million in donations to Congress. So they're really, you know, they are pushing the federal government to do more logging, and environmentalists are pushing the government to do less logging. So it's sort of a, you know, the middle ground there. And, you know, I think they mentioned that it's important because that limit essentially restricts a lot of types of treatment, including good treatments like fuels reduction. So Emerson agreed that there needs to be more site-specific analysis and treatments of these forests rather than a really broad brush, which is what this draft plan sort of does right now, especially in our region and the Rogue River, because the forests here are so different depending on where you are, even from hill to hill.
Do we know when this plan will be finalized?
Yeah, the Forest Service people stress that this draft is very much a draft, and a lot of changes could happen based on the public feedback they get. There's public comments for this draft plan that are due by March 17th, and then after that, it's going to take them a while to parse through those comments and decide what changes are needed. Molly Jularaw said that they'll probably have a finalized plan in the fall or winter of this year.
Great. Thanks, Roman.
So, Justin, you covered a lawsuit against Grants Pass that challenges the city's policies on homeless encampments. I feel like I'm getting some deja vu. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the lawsuit was filed yesterday by the nonprofit group Disability Rights Oregon and five disabled homeless residents. And they claim the city has violated state laws with recent restrictions on public camping. So, for some background, which usually hear from Jane about this. This is her beat. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court sided with the city, basically saying they can ban public camping for homeless, even if there's essentially nowhere for those homeless to go. Since then, Grants Pass has severely restricted public camping. They banned camping on all city property except for these two sites, these fenced-off areas. But recently, they closed one of those sites, the larger one, in fact, and they restricted the hours of that one to 5 p.m. to 7 a.m., so making it usable only overnight. If a homeless person doesn't follow these rules, then, you know, they can be ticketed or they can possibly even be arrested. But that Supreme Court ruling doesn't give Grants Pass, you know, total carte blanche in regulating homeless encampments. There's still state laws that the city has to follow. That's what the plaintiffs here are claiming, that what Grants Pass has set up for a homeless in their city breaks those laws.
Yeah, interesting. So there was the federal lawsuit before that the Supreme Court weighed on, and now we're focusing on state laws that were passed while that lawsuit was underway. What are those state laws then that the lawsuit alleges that Grants Pass has broken?
So the first one is a law that says homeless camping rules must be objectively reasonable. I'm not a lawyer, but that seems pretty vague. I mean, if one person disagrees with the law being reasonable, I don't know if that's objective. Again, not a lawyer. But the plaintiffs in this case say having only one site open overnight is not reasonable given the number of homeless people in the area. The other law is an Oregon statute protecting those with disabilities against discrimination. The plaintiffs in this case are all disabled, and they say having to move in and out of this remaining site is very difficult, you know, trekking their belongings in and out. I spoke with one of those plaintiffs, Jeffrey Dickerson. He's 56. He's lived in Southern Oregon his entire life, but he lost his apartment a year ago and has been living on the streets. He's on waiting list for housing. He also has neuropathy, that's a nerve condition, and he has severe spinal arthritis. So he says, you know, he packs light, but it's still extremely difficult for him to move in and out of this site. And there's people even in worse positions than he's in, people in wheelchairs even.
Yeah. So just quickly, what's the goal then of the lawsuit?
basically an injunction against the city to stop these rules they've set up for a homeless encampment. So they want Grants Pass to go back to the drawing board and figure something else out.
Got it. Great. Thanks, Justin. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. You can find that on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.